I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As a new administration heads to the White House, scientists around the nation are wondering if they'll continue to enjoy the same level of federal funding and support. WHYY's Tanya English reports.
There's lots of uncertainty about what President-elect Donald Trump will do next. But climate change scientists may be more concerned than most. Trump has called climate change a hoax, and that worries Elizabeth Arnold, founder of the Philadelphia environmental justice group, EDGE.
You know, people across the, across disciplines are especially worried about climate change and what this is going to mean for climate change, because some of the other areas of science and health funding don't seem to, aren't as political and probably aren't as threatened.
Arnold says if the new president decides to cut funding or pull back support for actions designed to slow global warming, his decisions will give activists a roadmap as they ask private foundations to fill the void. Sam Bernhardt with Food and Water Watch says Trump's victory should be a wake-up call for candidates who take a politically pragmatic stance on climate change. He says lukewarm actions don't motivate voters to show up on election day.
We hope that this is a real moment for both parties, but especially the one that lost, to realize that they need to do some real work figuring out what positions the people actually want them to take.
Many will be watching to see what the Environmental Protection Agency does as an indicator of Trump's policy on climate change. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Concerns about the United States' involvement in combating climate change echo across the globe as the United Nations Conference on Climate Change continues through Friday. Some 200 nations are represented at the COP22 Climate Conference in Marrakesh. That's where we find State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips. Susan, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Susan, one can only imagine that the tenor of the conference attendees changed dramatically 1 week ago today when the election results here in the States became finalized.
That's right, Dave. It's just shocking to everybody here. And I think everybody's wondering what's next with the U.S., whether it's going to pull out or not. Donald Trump, of course, has called climate change a hoax in his first 100-day plan for office. He actually stated that he's going to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement and not pay the funds that the Obama administration had committed to the Green Climate Fund. And the Green Climate Fund is money that would go to very poor nations to help them reduce their emissions. The U.S. had promised about $3 billion and has already sent in about $500 million. So everyone here is wondering, well, is the rest of that 2.5 million going to come through? And everyone is sort of singing the same tune, which is that no matter what the U.S. does, that the Paris Agreement will hold and that, they will go forward.
I hear you saying they're singing the tune that it will continue, but are they saying how it could possibly continue if the U.S. effectively pulls out?
They're saying there will definitely be impacts, of course, because if the U.S. government pulls out, then the target for carbon emissions, I guess, would have to be strengthened among the rest of the nations, because carbon emissions from the U.S. would continue to go up, not down. But the other thing folks are saying here as well, and including Ban Ki-moon, who spoke this morning, was that, look, the federal government is one thing, they negotiate the treaties, but there's a lot of states, including California, there are cities, including Philadelphia, who have their own climate plans to reduce emissions and to prepare for rising seas.
Is there apt to be much clarity when Secretary of State John Kerry addresses the group tomorrow?
Kerry did say that the State Department and the Obama administration would do all it could over the next couple of months to implement commitments they made in Paris. But right now, Kerry, as well as the entire U.S. delegation, is saying that they're continuing to negotiate as if they would have prior to the election. So much here is up in the air in terms of what the U.S. will do and what the impacts are. And the other interesting thing is, Dave, that everybody here seems to think that if you sit down with Donald Trump and reason with him, he will change his mind.
Right. That's the official position of UN General Secretary Ban Ki-moon.
Yes, that's what he said. He said today that he spoke to Donald Trump over the phone And he thinks he can be convinced because he's a person who understands market forces. And Ban Ki-moon says the market forces are clearly going towards renewables and away from fossil fuels. The French president, François Hollande, said today as well that he's going to lead a delegation to sit down and talk to Trump and explain to him why it is so important and why he should make climate change a priority.
So the best case scenario, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that change can continue to happen, but the pace at which it will do so will be greatly reduced under a Trump administration.
I think what the rest of the world is saying is with or without Trump, we're going to make progress. Now, the U.S. is the second largest emitter. So if they really want to make progress on reducing carbon emissions, that means that they're going to have to plan on reducing even more than they had before. And the U.S. was also one of the major contributors to the Green Climate Fund. And so if the U.S. pulls its money from that fund, then again, other countries are going to have to just pay more money.
Susan, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips. Her trip to Morocco is supported by a fellowship from the International Reporting Project. A federal judge has ordered that the NSA, National Security Agency, and FBI reveal whether they spied on Occupy Philadelphia protesters 5 years ago. The order followed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by attorney Paul Hetznecker. He says protesters need to know that their actions will not be illegally monitored by government agencies. Hetznecker adds that demonstrations' right to privacy and assembly freely are fundamental to democracy.
It's very important that we curb government interference in the exercise of those rights. And the first step in curbing governmental interference is revelation.
The FBI previously responded to Hetznecker's request, but most of it was blacked out. This time, the judge says the response needs to be free of redactions. Last Tuesday, many Pennsylvania voters from both sides of the aisle watched in surprise and, in some cases, shock as Donald Trump won the Commonwealth and was elected next president of the United States. Political analysts in the state were also taken aback. Most major polls never showed Trump winning Pennsylvania, let alone the national election. The state was thought to be part of opponent Hillary Clinton's so-called blue wall. What went wrong? WHYY's Katie Meyer reports that state pollsters are still trying to figure that out for themselves.
Lately, Muhlenberg College poll director Chris Borick has been getting some angry emails.
People are upset and they're, you know, angry with either that the polls gave them confidence that was unwarranted or that they thought the polls were biased because of some kind of nefarious reason.
And Terry Madonna, director of the Franklin and Marshall College poll, says his last few days have been similar. Madonna and Borick have been in the Pennsylvania polling business for years, and they provide political analysis and commentary on the side. F&M and Muhlenberg are well-rated surveys, which means they tend to be accurate. But both pollsters say this year they've never been farther off. And many other polls across the country are in the same exact boat. Borick says that's largely because on a fundamental level, this year was different. Over and over, pollsters underestimated the enthusiasm in Trump's base. He notes white working-class voters in Pennsylvania turned out in almost double the numbers they did for Mitt Romney in 2012.
I was truly skeptical about the idea of perhaps a silent Trump vote, that people were not telling pollsters, including us, that they were going to vote for Trump.
Throughout the campaign, Trump himself repeatedly insisted that his large, raucous rallies were a sign of a populist movement.
I hear we set a new record for this building. And by the way, I didn't have to bring J-Lo or Jay-Z, the only way she gets anybody. I'm here all by myself.
But Madonna says he mostly discounted that.
What Trump was saying, look at the size of the crowds, look at the yard signs. And I would sort of joke him by saying, yeah, there's hundreds of yard signs, but yard signs don't vote.
Now, of course, he's rethinking that approach.
Now, after the election, I also joked and said, maybe yard signs did vote. You know, we didn't pick up that.
Trump ultimately won the state by 1% of the vote. That's not enormously far off from the state poll average, which had Clinton up about 2 points right before the election. Still, it's a discrepancy. Madonna says a big reason he and others were off was because of non-response bias. Basically, those silent Trump voters Boric was so skeptical of, they were real. In F&M's case, one problem was methodology. This year, Madonna was experimenting with new ways of reaching voters. Traditionally, polls are conducted via landline. But now, Madonna says more and more people have cell phones, or just don't answer polling calls, particularly young people. So he tried his luck at reaching them in other ways.
Telephone interviewing in 5 to 10 years will probably be extinct. At least that's what some pollsters think. So this year, we included online polls, so about 40% of the people we interviewed conducted the poll online.
Madonna says he still thinks it was a valid idea, but it did throw off results.
There is no doubt that that skewed the poll towards the Democrats. And when I released it, I pointed that out to everybody so they would know that. I'm not making an excuse, but I'm just saying that we went into this fully aware that there had been problems developing over the years.
Boric says there was also another, perhaps trickier, problem. Pollsters and analysts interpreted their own results incorrectly.
That narrative that was building in the media and being woven in with the polling results might have blocked some legitimate questioning about some of the predictions.
So where do pollsters go from here? Madonna says he still trusts his model overall, but he's going to continue tweaking it.
We're going to continue to experiment with finding a balance between surveys online and telephone interviewees. That's going to take some more complicated statistical adjustments. The other problem was the regional breakdown. So we have to do a better job when we adjust the polls by region.
And Boric's still poring over his results, looking for ways to fix the flaws that became apparent this year.
Could it be an exceptional year? I mean, that's the question. And I've drawn no, firm conclusions as we, well, at least we'll have some time before we go back and do this again.
Boric and Madonna agree that at the end of the day, polls can't predict the future. For better or worse, it all comes down to the data. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
When you think about the Mexican Revolution, old films of Pancho Villa's troops going to battle might come to mind. Soldiers with bullet belts crisscrossing their chests stood proudly for the photographers. The bloody 1910 popular revolt overthrew a brutal tyranny. The monumental change in Mexico politics fostered an equally transformative art movement that's thoroughly documented in the Philadelphia Museum of Art major exhibition entitled Paint the Revolution, Mexican Modernism. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna reports.
You might say, oh no, another Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera story. But wait, the Kahlo you'll see at the museum is not the work of a woman preoccupied by her personal woes. This is the revolutionary painter who depicts the struggles of a country's growing pains. The poster for the exhibition has a self-portrait, of course, of a patriotic Kahlo standing at the border between the U.S. and Mexico.
To one side of her, you see these symbols of the U.S., skyscrapers, the Ford car factory from Detroit, which she visited with her husband while he was working on the Detroit industry murals, an American flag that's sort of appearing in the smoke above the smokestacks of the factory.
Says exhibition co-curator Mark Castro.
And then on the left, you see, a pre-Columbian pyramid, and you see this sort of rich and lush flowers and vegetation in the front whose roots you can see reaching into the soil. It's a great painting, I think, because it captures something of how she felt about this moment in her life when she was traveling between both countries.
The drawings, paintings, posters, publications, and murals show how artists collaborated with the revolutionary government. Matthew Afrin, the museum's modern art curator, says they were creating a new visual language, a language that depicts the struggles of working people and farmers and their hopes for a new country.
What you had really was the coming together of a generation of extremely innovative and ambitious artists with a social mandate.
It's the murals that give the modernists its most grandiose canvas. The problem for the museum was how to convey that experience short of bringing a mural to Philadelphia. Here, says Afrin, is where design ingenuity came into the picture.
We sent teams to Mexico City to make new photography, digital photography, of three great murals. Diego Rivera's Ballads of the Revolution from the Education Ministry in Mexico City is the first of those. And what visitors will see in the exhibition is a floor-to-ceiling, full-scale digital projection, which allows you, in effect, to take a kind of walk alongside a very, very high-quality reproduction. And we think that this replica will help to give people a feeling for what mural painting is that could be accomplished no other way.
Nearby, a large digital table allows the visitor to zoom in on the images and see the red ribbon with the words of revolutionary ballads Rivera painted in his mural. Similar digital techniques were used to depict the interior of a staircase, painted by David Alfaro Siqueiros in the Electrician Union's building in Mexico City. In an innovative use of space, the mural runs on three walls and the ceiling.
It goes not from left to right or right to left, but really vertically, from bottom to top. And as you walk, what you see are panels that allegorize the forces of capitalism, fascism, and war fighting with each other.
It makes you wonder, is art at the service of a cause or even a government a form of propaganda? Possibly, says curator Mark Castro.
What's important and what this show can do is to open your eyes to both the possibilities and the problems of art that has a very specific goal. I think there's a lot of possibilities for greater dialogue about the messages behind the art and about the way in which those messages are depicted.
And what you're not going to see in this exhibition is stereotypes.
On the contrary, says Afrand, he wants you to discover that the risk-taking and daring of these artists pointed to an original vision for the Americas that attracted people ranging from artists to industrialists from all over the world.
Because it was felt that something new for North America was coming out of Mexico, and that was a great, creative, innovative, socially oriented, morally consequential culture. And everyone understood that it was very relevant for tough times.
Paint the Revolution, Mexican Modernist Art, 1910 to 1950, will close January 8th. And then travels to the Museo del Palacio de Bellas Artes in Mexico City, who collaborated with the Philadelphia Museum of Art in creating this show. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Author Jennifer Tiga made a haunting discovery one day. Her grandfather was a notorious Nazi war criminal. She joins the show tomorrow night to discuss her book entitled My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.